This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, this is David Rutledge. Welcome once again to the Philosopher's Zone. And I want you to pay attention to the music in the background for a minute. It's got a sort of non-specific African feel to it. Tribal sounding drums, complex polyrhythms. But as it happens, the artist is a white musician who has never set foot on the African continent and is borrowing certain elements of African music. I'm not going to name and shame them. The intention behind the piece is actually satirical. It's meant as a sort of parody of 1950s exoticism in American music and film. So that's all well and good. But is it cultural appropriation, and is it therefore morally objectionable? The debate around cultural appropriation is highly contentious, and it's become one of those terrible nuance-free culture war zones where you're either doing cultural appropriation and that makes you a racist, or you're doing lefty cancel culture and trying to stifle artistic free expression. Well, this week we're steering up the middle of the whole mess and trying to introduce some fine moral and philosophical distinctions. My guests have been writing together on cultural appropriation for some time, and they are Luara Ferrascioli, who's senior lecturer in political philosophy at the University of Sydney. Hi, Luara. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
And I'm also joined by Samuel Spall, who's also at the University of Sydney, where he's senior lecturer in philosophy. Sam, welcome to you.
Thanks, David.
Sam, I want to begin on a personal note. You are Jewish, and there have been times when the appropriation of Jewish culture comes up for debate. One recent one was, I think it was in 2019, when a London West End production of a Broadway play about a Jewish family had no Jewish people involved, either among the actors or the production team. So before we get into the ethics of it, just personally, as a Jew, how do you respond to this sort of thing? Should a play about Jewish people feature Jewish actors?
Well, I appreciate your beginning with this question. There's a lot to say about it. The simple answer is that, yeah, I think in most circumstances, a play, which is a joint production, involves a lot of people and several actors, should probably involve representation of the group it is depicting. But first of all, I think the idea of Jewish culture is somewhat artificial, and I'd like to push back a bit on it. So, I mean, there are Jews, I mean, setting aside the complexities of Jewish history, just today, there are Jewish people living in Australia, in the US, in the UK, in Israel, in France, in Argentina, in Mexico, in Ethiopia, in South Africa, many other places, right? There are many Jewish cultures. I think in part because of that, I really feel uncomfortable with the idea that I am somehow authorized to speak on behalf of Jews. And finally, I think there are some ways that Jewish culture or, you know, Jewish cultural materials or aspects of one or another Jewish culture can be mimicked or used or transformed that are immensely productive and that should happen more.
Luara, I just wanted to ask you, you're Brazilian, and of course Brazilian culture or Brazilian cultures get plundered left, right and center all the time. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, so it's interesting for a Brazilian to complain about culture engagement at an abstract level, precisely because Brazilian culture has this very strong multicultural element. So we have indigenous cultures, which were quite diverse. We had many African cultures that came to Brazil as a result of slavery. We also then had the influence of Portuguese culture, Spanish culture. So even though we can kind of resent the fact that the formation of Brazilian culture was a result of all these injustices, right? Slavery, colonialism, forced assimilation, we can still celebrate this multicultural element of Brazilian culture. In terms of engagement by outsiders, I'm just a Brazilian from the South with my own experiences, background, but I'm someone who cares about many things, intellectual expression, social justice, etc. I think some engagement with Brazilian culture is beneficial to all parties concerned. So, for example, I think it's wonderful that people get to engage with Brazilian music outside Brazil, listen to you play the samba, for example. I think it benefits Brazilian artists, but some engagement is problematic. There's some contested cases, and I'm generally unsure about some of them. So there's the case of the head wrap that was traditionally worn by African Brazilian women. And some white Brazilian women have started to wear them. And some African Brazilian women have complained. And I can see the arguments from both sides are compelling. White women will say, look, there's more that unites us than that separates us. We have common cause. We're civic friends. We suffer from injustice. We love the head wrap. It's beautiful. We want to wear it. But African Brazilian women can respond by saying, look, we are one of the most marginalized groups in Brazil. You can get away with wearing the head wrap and not suffer kind of racial discrimination. I can't. So, you know, this is the type of case I think reasonable people can disagree about. And I'm not so sure where I stand. I'm still struggling with this case.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? And I mean, one thing I'm getting from what you're both saying here is that it's very difficult to establish clear-cut parameters around this. So having said that, it's a good point at which to jump into the philosophy of it. And I would like to begin that with talking about two common grounds for vindicating the charge of cultural appropriation where it arises. And one of them is referred to as the intimacy account. Can you, first of all, explain what this is, the intimacy account?
Sure. So I don't know if I would characterize the intimacy account as common ground. I think it's a recent account due to T. Nguyen and Matthew Stroll that is controversial. And for me, the really interesting core putative insight of this intimacy account of the wrongfulness of at least certain kinds of cultural engagement has to do with this idea that there are what we might call intimacy-based prerogatives, which give intimate groups something like a moral right to exclude other people who are not parties to the intimate group from certain kinds of use of that group's cultural materials, let's say. So the analogy that these authors give us is really striking. It goes something like this. Imagine a romantic couple, okay, who have these affectionate pet names for each other. And they're sort of private pet names. And somehow I'm friends of this couple, and somehow this information comes to me that they have these pet names and what they are. And they find out and they say, look, Sam, it's cool that you know about these pet names, but please don't use them, okay? They're our special thing. They're really meaningful to us. And we would really find it offensive if you started using them with your partner or with other people. And so Nguyen and Stroll think this is an example of a kind of special moral prerogative that's grounded in an intimate relationship. And then the sort of contentious move is to suggest that this special moral prerogative, which involves a right to exclude outsiders from employing these cultural materials, can actually apply to cultural groups.
Right. And it seems to me, I mean, what I like about that account, I guess, is that it avoids the problem of having to prove that any particular wrong or harm is being experienced as a result of cultural appropriation. It's just enough for the group to assert that, hey, this is our thing and we don't want outsiders taking it up. What's wrong with that appeal, in your view?
I don't think it's easy to make sense of the relevant group decision. In the case, at least, of many or most of the cultural groups that are the supposed victims in important cases of cultural appropriation. So what I mean is that it's pretty easy to make sense of a univocal decision of a romantic couple or even a throuple or a four-person relationship, right? If they get together and say, here's our decision, we're sticking to it. Sam, our friend, please don't use the names. Okay, there's a group decision there. It is clear and transparent, and the decision-making mechanism is clear, and so on. When we're talking about a group like American Jews or Asian Australians or Muslims across the world or whatever, these groups are too large, too diverse, and too bereft of authoritative decision-making procedures to make them, in my view, sufficiently analogous to this sort of intimate personal relationship.
I agree with Sam. The issue about group agency is really key here. There is always a worry that it's the most vocal members that will end up deciding what it is that the group wants or they have been given an opportunity to speak, right? Sometimes the members that actually have the best arguments have been ignored or haven't been given an opportunity to speak, or maybe have chosen not to speak because they don't want conflict. They don't think it's worth it. So it's tricky to then to assume that because some members think X, the group thinks X. It is, I think, the main problem with the intimacy account.
Right. And does that also then apply to this notion of group ownership? Say I'm a musician, a white musician, and I've been listening to a lot of traditional Senegalese folk music, and I want to use its particular rhythms and motifs and so on in my compositions. What if a Senegalese musician comes to me and says, well, that's all fine, but my culture asserts ownership rights over these musical elements, and it's not for you to violate those rights. You can argue about the ethics all you want, but at the end of the day, this is about autonomy-based ownership rights and whether or not we, the custodians of this tradition, consent to your using what we own. I mean, that's a very commonly heard appeal. Does that also sort of run onto the rocks of this thing that you're talking about where the whole question of who speaks for the group is contentious?
Yeah, so I would say that there is a possibility that some other members of the group disagree, right? And they think it's great when there is engagement with the music. When other people listen to it, it creates maybe some economic opportunities. It brings cultural understanding between the groups. It might even lead to the fostering of intimate or political relationships. And then we need to kind of dig deeper into these issues to see whether you do something wrong by not following the directive of the first person that objected to your use of the motives.
If I could add, there may well be intellectual property rights in particular rhythms or songs that are held by individual musicians. There might be broader sorts of things that resemble group ownership by, say, a certain tradition of Senegalese musicians that have sustained and refined certain rhythms or standard modes of musical expression. And it may well be that in some cases, the use of those particular rhythms is a violation of either intellectual property rights or something resembling that, but a little looser and more poorly defined. And I think when you're in that kind of territory as a musician, you do well to, for example, try to employ Senegalese musicians to play the music with you. I mean, they're probably going to make your music better anyway, right? But I do think that there are plenty of types of music that were sort of invented and pioneered by members of one cultural group and then were opened up to others. I mean, jazz music is one of my favorite forms of music. And there's a lot to be said about the early days of jazz and many other important American musical forms. But many of us think it's not the case that only Black Americans are now permitted to play jazz music. People all around the world, talented musicians, play jazz standards, even the songs that everyone else played. And I think that's a good thing.
Human beings are the types of creatures that want to explore the social world around them. And there are multiple cultures in that social world. And they realize that different cultures deal with the human predicament in different ways, and yet intelligible ways. And they're sometimes attracted to the different answers that different cultural groups have given to this kind of shared, difficult questions that we as human beings are always trying to answer. So a lot can be lost when we kind of close our social world and say, look, I can only engage with the materials of my own culture. The answers that my culture gives around what stories are important, how to tell a story, how to dress, how to move my body when I listen to music are kind of definitive and the right answers for me for the rest of my life. I think I lose as an individual, and I think we as a society lose when we don't engage with each other, when we don't try and kind of answer those questions together. So I think if done respectfully, without exploitation, mischaracterization, misrepresentation, causing legitimate offense, if it's just this engagement, this kind of with other cultures, then not only I think we as individuals can gain a lot, but also that can form the basis of productive cross-cultural relationships. So I do think there's a lot to be lost here, if we are not nuanced about these questions, if we just kind of put it all aside and say it's always dangerous, there's, you know, because of inequality, because of oppression, we should never engage with each other's culture, let's just have a presumption against engagement, I think we're going to lose a lot.
I think it's really critical to recognize that offending people is sometimes seriously wrong. For example, one of the reasons that noxious stereotypes are wrong is that they cause legitimate offense. But it's also really critical to distinguish between a particular offense reaction, someone's being offended, my being offended, and it being fitting for me to be offended. And no individual person's offense reactions are sacrosanct or the last word on any particular matter. So while I think it's incredibly important to respect individuals and particularly to respect members of cultural groups which have been historically marginalized and oppressed, and we should be especially careful and sensitive to those persons' offense reactions, I don't think the proper way to respect individuals or groups is to take them as unquestionably, finally authoritative on any particular matter.
And just,
yes, can I also add to that?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I feel strongly about this as someone who is a member of several disadvantaged groups, right? I'm a woman. Colonialism had finished by the time I was born, but it was very much there in the institutions, in how we relate to one another, etc. So I grew up in a country marked by colonialism. And although I'm a skilled immigrant here in Australia, I'm still part of a group that didn't grow up here, doesn't speak English as a first language, etc. So in many ways, I'm a member of several disadvantaged groups. But I do find it a bit patronizing and to some extent disrespectful for my views to be taken as necessarily correct merely in virtue of this of my membership in those groups, right? I want to be treated as an equal agent who has equally good critical capacities. I want my arguments to be evaluated on their own terms, on their own merit. And when we just say, well, if you've suffered oppression or if you suffer oppression, then your word is the last word on the matter. Like say, as a woman, if I suffer sexism, then that's it. Whatever I say about sexism here trumps anything that you both might say. Well, I think there's something patronizing about that and frankly disrespectful because it's almost like we're not engaging on equal terms. And even though there is something nice about being always right, it's not conducive to my growth as an individual and the growth of all of us as a community.
This is The Philosopher's Zone. You're listening to it on RN with me, David Rutledge, and my guests this week, Luara Ferrascioli and Samuel Spall, both from the University of Sydney, and both doing some very interesting work on cultural appropriation. So I think at this point we should maybe underline something important in the discussion here, and that's that neither of you is saying that the various harms that come under the banner of cultural appropriation, whether those harms are exploitation or misrepresentation or silencing or whatever it is, you're not saying that these are insignificant harms. What you are saying, if I have you correct, is that lumping all of these together under the rubric of cultural appropriation is confusing and not particularly helpful. So how is that the case?
Absolutely. We do think that there are all these wrongs. Sometimes they can be quite severe, such as causing fitting offense, exploiting, right? So taking advantage of a practice that has been sustained over time and not appropriately reward that work done by individuals, often marginalized individuals. We think there are several wrongs that people engage in when they engage with a culture. But we don't think that calling those things cultural appropriation is very helpful. First, because when we talk about cultural appropriation, it's over-inclusive. There's all these other things that people also think count as cultural appropriation that are not wrong. So we don't then attend to the specificities of the wrong in question. And by failing to do that, we are not well-equipped to determine whether someone should be blamed and should apologize and remedy the situation, and we risk blaming individuals who haven't actually done anything wrong. So there is a worry that we don't blame when we should blame and assign responsibility, but also we blame and sanction people who haven't done anything wrong, because the label of cultural appropriation obscures more than it reveals. It doesn't allow us to get to the root of the problem, as it were.
I guess I would add a bit of an abstract, but I think important philosophical note. So I think that employing moral concepts that are unhelpful umbrella terms, that are too loose, that are poorly defined, that people use without really having a coherent conceptualization of what they refer to, I think employing those kinds of concepts is always somewhat dangerous, but I think it's all the more dangerous the more that those concepts come to occupy a central role in really consequential political discussions and debates. So I think that the term or the concept of cultural appropriation has come to be increasingly prominent in the past, let's say, two decades. It's poorly defined and hodgepodgey nature leads to really poor standards of discussion. And I think poor standards of discussion are bad for democracy. So while we absolutely should be calling out exploitation, we absolutely should be calling out stereotypical, denigrating misrepresentations, while we absolutely should be calling out silencing of marginalized peoples, if and when that's occurring, these are very different wrongs. They have different moral character. They require very different remedies. And so we should be calling them out with precise, descriptive moral terminology that facilitates our giving compelling arguments for our views and taking seriously the views of our opponents in particular cases. And that's what we're really advocating.
But as you both point out in your work, we have racism, which encompasses a large and varied set of wrongs and injustices, just like cultural appropriation. Would you say the same thing about racism, that it's a confusing and unhelpful concept?
I would say something connected but a bit different about racism. So on the one hand, I think that there are better concepts than the concept of racism, and they are slowly coming to replace it, at least in many sophisticated discussions. So again, this is a relatively recent phenomenon, but now you see more and more attention to the difference between, for example, explicit racial animus and implicit racial bias, to the difference, for example, between particular instances of racial discrimination and what's sometimes called structural racism. So these more targeted, nuanced concepts, I think, are incredibly productive. One of the things they allow us to do is give more persuasive arguments and attain a lot more knowledge and self-knowledge. So, really important example, I think, nowadays, many of us white people realize that we might have been wrong 20 years ago to think something like the following: well, since I have no explicit racial prejudice, I can't be complicit in racism, right? Many of us discarded that, I think, false and dangerous view, largely because we've come to see that not all quote-unquote racism is rooted in explicit racial prejudice. So on the one hand, what we want to say about a concept like racism, I think, does parallel what we want to say about the notion of cultural appropriation. But there's an important difference, which is that the concept of racism has a long-standing history in the English language. It would be much harder to totally replace and do away with. And so it just wouldn't be prudent to advocate the wholesale evisceration of the concept of racism. And, you know, maybe cultural appropriation as a notion is useful in some contexts. I think that sort of remains to be seen. It's much easier, I think our view is, to chip away at its importance in the contemporary political lexicon.
And I would just add that when artists are deciding what artwork to engage with or what idea to pursue, they have a stringent duty of care. If they are engaging with a culture that they are not a member of, they should know that there is a significant risk of, say, misrepresentation. And so they should do a lot of research and feel fairly confident that they are not going to misrepresent a group and therefore contribute to oppression and inequality. So we're not saying write anything and write in any way and, you know, and everyone just has to kind of accept. We're not at all suggesting that. What we are suggesting is that we shouldn't preempt the artists will always do that. We should give them the benefit of the doubt and have these more nuanced conversations about it precisely so that they can do it in a way that discharges this duty of care. But if we're just shouting at each other, accusing them of engaging cultural appropriation, etc., well, there's this loss that Sam already alluded to, but there's also kind of the risk that an artist might feel that their freedom of expression is being curtailed to such an extent that they don't pay attention to any of these other important issues around, say, misrepresentation, etc. So there is also a risk that we lose potential allies in the collective struggle to bring about a more equal, more just world, which artists can be a part of. So we don't want them to feel that the only way they can do it is by not doing art in the way they want to do. We want them to feel that there's a duty that comes with that engagement. It has to be done respectfully. You can't reinforce stereotypes, et cetera, et cetera. But the mere engagement is not morally problematic. And a lot of the discussion in the public debate around cultural appropriation assumes precisely that.
Luara Ferrasioli, senior lecturer in political philosophy at the University of Sydney. And she was there with Samuel Spall, senior lecturer in philosophy also at the University of Sydney. And that brings us to the end of the Philosopher's Zone for this week. But I hope you can join me next week because we're going to be talking about racism and what we're actually discussing when we talk about racism. Here's a preview.
It's actually really an unstable concept, and it needs to be enacted via laws, via policies, via discourses, via cultural productions. All of these types of things form what Alexander Ohelia calls a series of racializing assemblages. In other words, ways in which race is enacted as an idea through the everyday in order to maintain this dominance of white power in the colonial context. So that's why I think it's much more efficient to talk about race as a project and a process, in other words, as doing something rather than being something.
Her name is Alana Lenton. She's doing some really interesting and very important work on race, and she's my guest next week in the Philosopher's Zone. I'm David Rutledge. You can find me on Twitter at DavidPZone, and of course you can also find streaming and download links of all of our past programs on the Philosopher's Zone website or via the ABC Listen app. Thanks for your company. See you next week.